It is the Burt Cohen Show. Or may not have heard about what's going on in Canada right now. In Montreal in specific, there's been a lot of noise going on. Something called the Casseroles Night in Canada, which has been a part of the Maple Spring. It started with a protest over a massive increase in student tuition rates in Montreal, and has really taken off from there. There are demonstrations in support all around the world. Ethan Cox is a 28-year-old organizer from Montreal, a spokesperson for Casseroles Night in Canada. Sounds tasty. The international solidarity campaign with Quebec and students. He's worked as a union organizer with the Public Service Alliance of Canada. He's also worked on several successful municipal and federal election campaigns and was a member of the Quebec Central Office staff for the NDP. I believe that's the New Democratic Party in the 2011 election. Is that right?
Yes, yes, it is.
And Americans have heard a little, frankly, if anything, about Quebec's student strike. What sparked it, and how long has it gone on? I want to find out all about this. It seems like it's got a lot of people really fired up in Canada and throughout the world. So what sparked it, really?
Well, the Quebec government announced actually about a year and a half ago that their plans to increase tuition by 75%. And so these things take time to build. So I think it's fair to say that for about a year and a half, there was organizing going on campuses, building towards a strike. And in February, about 40 to 45% of the post-secondary students in Quebec went on an unlimited general strike and have been on one ever since.
And what is the normal tuition increase? And you know, this is obviously a sensitive issue anywhere there is a state-supported higher education program, that sometimes tuitions just have to go up because, it's difficult economic times. How out of the norm is this 75% increase?
Well, the important thing to understand is in Quebec, our tuition was frozen for an extremely long time. In fact, in Quebec, we have a long history of going on strike when there is an attempt to raise tuition. And in almost every occasion, the students have been successful. So that's why you often hear the phrase that we have the lowest tuition in North America. It's because we have a history of fighting for it. So basically, Charest had increased tuition by a little bit about 4 years ago, but aside from that, it had been frozen for a long time, and that's because of the willingness of Quebec students to fight for that freeze.
Now, it's difficult economic times all around. A lot of people are taking hits everywhere, and people are losing their jobs. How realistic was it that it could stay frozen for a lot, you know, the foreseeable future?
Well, quite realistic, really. It's It's a matter of two things. It's a matter, first of all, of priorities. In Quebec, the Charest government has given billions of dollars of tax cuts to profitable corporations, which have not produced the jobs they were supposed to, which have not produced the economic stimulus they were supposed to. We know that from studies that have been done that completely free post-secondary education in Quebec would cost about $350 million a year, which is less than 3% of the annual budget of the Ministry of Education. And we also know that free education or cheap education is the single best investment we can make in the future economic prosperity of our society. We know that for every dollar that we invest in education, we get about $10 back in the higher taxes that university graduates pay on their higher salaries. So it's an extraordinarily good investment, and it's an extraordinarily cheap one, really, in terms of the return that's provided. And if we want to have a knowledge-based economy, if we want to be able to compete with countries like Germany, which is considered sort of a model of austerity and fiscal prudence, but has free post-secondary education, and as a result, you know, partially of that, has one of the strongest economies in Europe, then we need to have a well-educated population. So it's really, people kind of sometimes talk about it like it's an entitlement, but investing in post-secondary education is an incredibly good investment for the future prosperity of our society.
Yeah, it would be nice if facts like that mattered here in the country south of your border, these United States. People don't always seem to get the investment quality, never mind anything else, just simple investment, as opposed to, as you mentioned, giveaways to big corporations who tend to pocket the money by a few people at the top. Well, let's hear about the political context for this all. The name Charest, a lot of people don't know who Jean Charest is. Tell us who he is and the political context that all this is happening in.
Sure. Well, Jean Charest is the premier of Quebec. He's been in power since 2003. He represents the Quebec Liberal Party, but the name should not be confusing.
Right.
They're an extremely right-wing conservative party. Sometimes these names get twisted around a little bit, and so that's basically the most right-wing party that we have in Quebec.
And how long has he been premier?
Since 2003.
2003. And what? So there's the Liberal Party on the right. What are the other parties there?
Unfortunately, in Quebec, our politics has always been a little screwy because we also have the issue of sovereignty. People may know there was a referendum in 1980 and 1995, and both of them were lost, but were relatively close. And so there's an ongoing movement for Quebec to separate from the rest of Canada. So our politics have unfortunately always had a secondary axis of federalism and sovereignty laid on top of left and right. So we have the Parti Québécois, which is the sovereigntist party, which is also the vaguely center-left party.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other main party. And then only very recently there's been a new right wing party created called the Coalition for Quebec's Future, which was created from the remnants of another sort of more extreme right wing party. And then we also have Quebec Solidaire, which is the only really left wing party in Quebec, but is relatively small, and actually only has one seat in the National Assembly right now. Unfortunately, our elections tend to have this secondary tone where a lot of federalists will vote for the Liberal Party because it's a federalist party, even though they might be left-wing and the Liberal Party is not. And, you know, right-wing sovereigntists as well might vote for the PQ rather than the Liberal Party because they're voting for the issue of sovereignty over the left-right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the left-right divide. Interesting. Yeah, politics does get complex and personalities come in there. So the protests, well, perhaps you can describe this. This sounds particularly interesting. And as I did some research on this, there's a lot of real interesting photographs. I mean, it sounds like It's been big. As you talked about what happened in the protests on May 22nd, which you say was a very rainy day. You expected not very much, but apparently it was the largest demonstration in Canadian history. Tell us about that, and was it mostly students? And perhaps this is a way of segueing into Law 78. Tell us about what that. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, basically, for some reason, the 22nd of each month has been the largest protest, the sort of generally acknowledged day when everybody was going to protest. So they've been large. April 22nd was about 200,000. March 22nd was about 100,000+, and then May 22nd was somewhere around 400,000 people in the streets. And one of the reasons for that was prior to May 22nd, in an attempt to shut down the strike and sort of shut down the social movement that was going on, the Charest government passed Bill 78, which is a an extremely draconian law, which among other things severely clamps down on the right to protest, requires protests to basically get permission from police, submit their route 8 hours in advance, all of the information about the protest, et cetera, et cetera. It imposes extremely heavy fines, up to $125,000 on student organizations or individuals even who are seen to be encouraging people to break the law. It also reverses the legal onus, and reverses sort of thousands of years of legal precedent by saying that it's the responsibility of a student association or federation to prove that their supporters or their members were not acting on their behalf if they broke the law. And if they can't prove that, then they can be subject to fines. It's an extremely heavy-handed, repressive crackdown on basically, the freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. It's written so broadly that it would allow the government to fine people or charge people for instance, promoting a quote unquote illegal protest on Twitter. And things like this. And, it's been really absolutely unaccepted. And so once that was passed, it really gave a second wind to the movement here and really broadened the support for it. And people who might not have necessarily supported the students or supported them enough to come out on the street and protest, I think really saw that bill and said, well, no, wait a minute, this has gone too far. We need to oppose this. So on the 22nd of May, it was not only the largest protest in Canadian history, it was also the largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history, because the protest was quite deliberately illegal, and so you had a situation where there were about 400,000 people breaking the law at the same time, and since this law has been brought in, it's been completely ignored, and so every protest that's happened in Montreal since has been illegal. And unfortunately, the corollary of this is that the police sort of go back and forth between being extremely repressive and allowing protests to go on. But we've had about 3,500 arrests, most of them mass arrests using the tactic known as kettling, where the police will basically surround a protest or a section of a protest and block it in and arrest everyone, including bystanders and people walking down the street and what have you. And so it's unfortunately a very repressive situation and a situation where there's a lot of civil disobedience happening.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Ethan Cox, an organizer from Montreal. We're looking into what the heck is going on up there. The mainstream media in America tends to be a little bit, shall we say, provincial and focus on things that just affect us. But this is really significant. This Law 28, how did this come to be? And is it unprecedented? Is there normally a tradition of freedom of speech, of the right to protest in Quebec?
Yeah, absolutely. It's Bill 78. But yeah, no, there certainly is, and I think it's been interesting to see. Quebec has a tradition of protest. Quebec has a tradition. You know, if you go back in our history, we had the Quiet Revolution in the 1960s, where prior to that there had been a minority of Anglophones who had sort of been the elite and the economic elite, and had sort of been in charge. And so although the majority spoke French, the minority and the power and the money and everyone was English, and so Francophones were sort of second class citizens. Mm-hmm. And there was what's referred to as the Quiet Revolution of sort of protests and throwing off this oppression. And then again in the 1970s, we had the October Crisis, where there was a radical sovereigntist group that bombed a couple of mailboxes and kidnapped a couple of people. And in response to that, the federal government imposed the War Measures Act and brought in the army. And so Quebec has a really strong tradition of protest and of resistance. And really is not the type of place that's going to accept this type of infringement on our civil liberties lying down, you could say.
Mm-hmm. And so this 400,000 people, this Law 78 that was supposed to clamp down and I guess basically eliminate the right of protest by having that, it sounded like guilty unless proven innocent kind of thing about, you know, if somebody out in the streets breaks a law, the organization would be assumed to be responsible for that. I mean, that's a little bit amazing. How did this, how much did that contribute to such a large crowd? And how does the public now feel about, the original student protest with regard to the 75% increase in tuition, and B, this sudden repression of Jean Charest?
Yeah, well, the Bill 78 really backfired, and you know, when I'm telling you that on the 22nd of May there were about 400,000 people in the streets, to give you a little bit of context, that's roughly the number of university students that exist in the province of Quebec. And this was a protest that was only in the city of Montreal, where there's maybe 100 to 150,000 students. So, right. And obviously they weren't all there. So what you're seeing is the society at large has taken up the cause of this social movement. And a lot of that has to do with reaction to Bill 78 and with people just being really unwilling to accept this. So it's really strongly backfired on Charest. And in terms of the population, The last poll that was done was about 60% opposed to Bill 78, but that was a couple weeks ago. It was sort of a situation where when Bill 78 was first unveiled, it was sort of a 50-50 split of support and opposition, and the more people understood what was actually in the bill. You know, it takes a little while for this sort of information to trickle through to everybody, especially when it's a little complicated. The more and more people understood what was in the bill, the more and more opposition towards it rose.
Sure.
And so, you know, the last polls that were done, you basically saw a situation where, you know, there was generally, you know, unfortunately, because of the way this issue is framed in the mainstream media, even here in Quebec, which is just complete propaganda in terms of saying it's a bunch of spoiled students who, you know, don't know how good they have it, blah, blah, blah. We started out in a situation where the majority of the population supported the government, and especially after Bill 78, those numbers have just swung massively. And now you have only about 27% of the Quebec population in the last poll that support the proposed increases of Charest.
Amazing. Yeah, I always find it, well, sad and amusing too when people just ignore history. In the late 1960s and early 70s here in the United States, when the government was repressive, well, guess what? Hello, it backfired, just like it apparently has done there. And they refused to get that. And so I guess in about 70 locations across Canada and throughout the world now, people have taken to the streets to voice their solidarity with this new social movement. Why is it called Casseroles Night? Is it, you know, one big feast or what?
Well, basically, it's named after a protest tradition that actually started in South America, in Chile, as a form of protest against the Pinochet dictatorship. Right. And people would go outside at the same time at night and bang pots and pans, basically bang wooden spoons on metal pots and basically make a racket. And it was a type of protest that was done in people's communities and sort of made it a little bit easier to avoid the type of repression or arrest that might happen at larger demonstrations. And so after Bill 78 was passed, this is something that people started doing in Quebec. So what the casseroles are basically is that at 8 p.m. every night, people come out into the street in their community. So it's not like big marches that are organized in one place, but, 1,000 different marches all over the place. So people will come out into the street in their community with their neighbors and start banging on their pots and pans and walking around. And, the reason for sort of trying to export it was that, I had written an article, about 2 weeks ago, saying that when we were covering what was going on in this situation, everybody's coverage, including my own, was using words like conflict and crisis and talking about the urgency of a solution. And that really didn't mesh too well with what I was seeing in the street, which was this really joyful, happy expression of solidarity and community, where people were coming out into the streets, meeting neighbors they never knew they had, and really coming together as communities and doing so in a way that was really positive and contributed to community building. So my editor and I were kind of discussing this and said, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could, share these casseroles with people in the rest of the country? And so I said, hey, let's call it Casserole Night in Canada, which is a play on Hockey Night in Canada, which is a very iconic tradition here that on Saturday night on the public broadcaster, there's always the hockey games, and traditionally people tended to watch hockey on Saturday night. So we put a little post, a little tag at the end of my post, calling on people that Wednesday to come out and have casseroles around the country, and we created a Facebook event. And it sort of took off beyond our wildest dreams. And in the first 72 hours, we had over 70 locations across Canada, but also internationally in Brussels and London and Paris and New York and Washington and many other places, Little Rock, Arkansas. And then in the next week to the next Wednesday, which was last Wednesday, we went up to about 125 locations with a bunch more in Europe and the U.S., And then the third installment is this Wednesday, and we're building towards a really big casserole night in Canada on the 22nd of this month, because that will be the next major demonstration in Quebec. We're expecting about 500,000 people in the streets, and so we're going to really try and build as large as possible of a international solidarity demonstration on the 22nd, and try and have really significant crowds in cities around the U.S. and Canada and Europe on the 22nd.
And why do you think people are falling into this? I suppose it's some kind of fun to go out there and make noise, but also a government depends on the consent of the governed for its legitimacy. They depend on people silently acquiescing in what they're doing, and the making of noise is just the opposite of quietly consenting. So it's demonstrating quite vividly that there is not consent of the governed. So why is this catching on so much in Europe and other places? It can't just be about the sounds like I have competition from a computer there.
Sorry. Just needed to plug my phone in.
Uh-huh. Well, oh, sure. Need electricity, I'm sure. But why is this catching on so much? It's not just about the 75% tuition increase. Or what's your sense of that?
No, absolutely not. The reason it was stunning to us as well to see how much solidarity there was internationally. But I think what it comes down to is that the fight in Quebec is the same fight that we have across Canada, across North America, and around the world, which is with a broken system that hands out billions of dollars in tax cuts to corporations and high income earners, and then turns around and pleads poverty as government slash social programs, and that's, you know, call it austerity, call it what you will, but that's a common problem around the world. And so I think for many people, they see Quebec, they see the history of social movements that Quebec has, the history of unionism and of popular resistance, and they feel that Quebec is the front line in this battle, and that that if anybody has a chance of really standing up to neoliberal governments, to the austerity agenda, and being able to actually win, that it's Quebec. And so I think for a lot of people, it's a matter of looking to Quebec as an inspiration and a role model, and saying, well, look, Quebec has to win, because if Quebec can't win, you know, what chance do we have?
Ah, interesting point. We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Ethan Cox, organizer from Montreal. And for what publication or blog do you write?
I write for rabble.ca, rabble.ca. Uh-huh. And that's probably the largest progressive news site in Canada. And so we've been doing pretty extensive coverage of the social movement in Quebec, and I'm the special correspondent on it for them.
Quite fun, I'm sure. Now, what I assume this Bill 78 had to go through a legislative process, did it not? I mean, it didn't just come down as an executive order from Jean Charest, did it? And follow up to that is, how the heck is the legislature reacting? They can't be real pleased with all the noise in the streets.
Well, the Liberal Party of Jean Charest has the majority, so unfortunately they can kind of do what they please. And you know how it tends to be. Actually, it's probably even a little bit worse here. You know, members of a party are going to be loyal to that party, and they're going to do what their leader tells them to do. And so it's very rare that that a member of a party would break ranks with their own party and oppose something they were doing. So it passed with the support of all the Liberals in the legislature. All of the opposition members voted against it, but from the PQ and Quebec Solidaire anyway. And you know that that wasn't enough, so it was able to pass, and that's the situation that we have right now, and hopefully Liberals are starting to get a little bit worried. We had a couple of by-elections, as a matter of fact, just last night, in two ridings which were both Liberal strongholds, and had been held by the Liberals for quite a long time, and in one of them, the Liberals were actually defeated by the PQ. And this is a riding where the Liberals had been in power for 46 straight years, so sort of the definition of a stronghold, and they were turfed out, and the PQ beat them with fairly high turnout for a by-election. So I think we're still sort of seeing what kind of shockwaves that's going to throw through things, but I think it's definitely going to have Charest and the Liberals sort of re-examining their electoral prospects, because they also have to go to the polls by next fall at the latest. It's their option to call the election, but they have a little over a year to do so. So obviously there's a blowback. Obviously that had something to do with one of those by-elections being lost last night. Uh-huh. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens, but you know, the problem is here that we don't have a great electoral solution. The PQ has been on side with the students, but in an extremely opportunistic way, and everybody sort of recognizes that. And so you have this sort of unfortunate situation where people are like, well, we hate the PQ too, but, you know, hey, it's slightly lesser evil than the Liberals. And, you know, Quebec Solidaire, which is really the party that represents the movement and is well-respected within it, it will improve their standing in the next election and probably go from one representative to maybe six or seven, but it's not enough to realistically be able to take government. So I think people in Quebec, also one of the motivating factors of this mass movement is a real dissatisfaction with the electoral options, and that people feel that they don't really have an ability to make the change that they want to see through the ballot box. And that's part of why they're on the street.
I wonder if there'll be any kind of a waiting game. I'm trying to figure out what it must feel like to be on the other side. Maybe they're thinking, well, you know, how long can people keep coming out on the streets? You know, when will the weather, you know, keep them at home? Although the weather was not good on May 22nd, as you mentioned. Are there people within the Quebec government that are pushing for negotiations and for compromise this, or are they digging in their heels mostly?
Well, since the whole thing began, there have only been two sets of negotiations, and over about 120-something odd days of strike, the government has actually only sat down with the students for about 6 days. So early on, the government sat down, and there was an offer that was presented that the student leaders gave to their members to vote without recommending it or not recommending it, mm-hmm. which was a pretty terrible offer, which was basically to keep the same tuition hikes, but to have a board made up of some students, but a majority of government and business reps looking at trying to save money in university administration, because this is a big problem we have, where our university administrations are really terrible at managing their funds and waste a lot of money, and that any savings there would be passed on to students through reductions to the tuition increase. But it was a bad offer. It didn't really address any of the issues, and so that was rejected overwhelmingly by about 97% of the students on strike. And since then, there were negotiations just a couple weeks ago now. And in those negotiations, the government basically, they had originally, the original tuition increase was $1,625 over 5 years. They then subsequently increased that to $1,778 over 7 years, so that they could sort of say, oh, but look, the annual increase is lower now. But of course, in real terms, it was making the increase larger, and so what they had offered in that negotiation was to reduce the increase to $1,624 over 7 years, which basically was a reduction of $1 of the original amount of the increase, which obviously is not something that really anyone is going to accept. That's in a negotiation.
Yeah.
So, and, go ahead. Sorry?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, and so that was what was offered by the government. The students, on the other hand, had made four different proposals, all of which were revenue neutral. So in other words, all of which were proposals for how to find the money that the increase would bring in other places. None of those were seriously considered by the government, and the government actually unilaterally broke off negotiations and walked away. So really, you know, talk about bad faith. The government's education minister in these negotiations was quite clear to the student leaders that her concern was not losing faith, that they had to be seen to win, and that her main concern was not really resolving the situation, but saving face for the government. So it was really, you know, bad faith negotiations on the government's part, and really no willingness to explore anything except, you know, take the increase we want or shove it. So the government's been extremely stubborn up to this point, and just refused to really negotiate in good faith or been completely unwilling to make any real compromise.
It's amazing throughout history, once again, how, you know, saving face has been such a motivating force, and how much damage has come from people in power wanting to save face. What kind of wiggle room do they have now? It seems, I mean, are they just digging themselves in deeper and deeper and deeper into the hole? They have to eventually compromise somehow, don't they?
Well, I think what you said before is accurate, that they're sort of playing a bit of a waiting game. Students have been in the streets every night, marching. People have been out with the casserole for, I think it's about the 45th straight day of the regular evening demonstrations. So the strike's been going on for about 120 days, but for about the last 45 days, there's been a demonstration every night at the same time in Montreal. And, you know, often people are marching 4, 5, 6 hours a night. And obviously that takes a fairly significant physical toll, and people are getting tired. And
yes.
So there's definitely an aspect of the government trying to wait the students out. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Some of the labor unions are starting to talk seriously about trying to lay the groundwork for a general strike. And if that were to happen, then I think that would really change the ball game dramatically. But I'm not sure if it's something that's going to be possible.
Yeah, general strikes are awfully difficult to pull off. But if they can happen, it's the most powerful weapon there is. Just really powerful. And the universities, you mentioned how they haven't had a lot of, that there's been some overspending. Is there some way of, that you and that the movement, the Maple Spring movement, whatever, would suggest for running the universities without such high expenses on the administration end, such a top-heavy aspect of the administration? Has that been put forward yet?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's when I was speaking about the students' revenue neutral proposals. A lot of it was about university governance. I think one of the proposals that they were making was to have a very minimal bank tax that would raise more than the amount of money required to pay for tuition. But again, you know, at the end of the day, it is important to deal with the mismanagement in the universities. But what's more important is that people don't understand how minimal the amount of money required to make education, for instance, completely free is, and what kind of a return on the investment we get for that. And that's really the point here, is that it's not about, is the tuition lower or higher? Is it, something that it's a matter of, we have a situation where people are graduating with huge debt, and it's much worse in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
And we also have to understand that when people graduate with huge debt loads, it means that they are discouraged from entrepreneurship, from public service, from volunteerism, where you might have somebody that graduated from law school and went and started up a storefront legal aid clinic. You know, now they're going to go straight into corporate law because they need to be making the money to pay off their student loans. You know, where you had somebody that might go and take a poorly paying job in the public service because they wanted to give back to their community, they're going to go take a job in the private sector because they need the money to pay back their student loans. And, you know, whereas somebody might sit in their garage and come up with the next Apple or Google, they're going to go get a job working for a company because they need to immediately start paying back those loans. So we also have to understand the cost, the social cost of saddling our young people with these absurd levels of debt, because it really impoverishes our society. And it means we have fewer university graduates, we have less tax revenue going forward. It's just, you know, it's really not even a left-right issue. No matter what your politics, it's really a short-sighted versus long-sighted issue. Because if you're looking at the long term, if you're looking at 20 years down the road, it's undeniable that making university as universally accessible as possible is going to make for a wealthier society, for a stronger economy, and for a broader and larger tax base that's going to be able to fund government. So there's really no excuse from either left or right to not want to invest in education.
And that does bring up my next question. The leadership of the protest, is it coming from a traditional left, or is it somehow transcending left-right?
Well, leadership is a hard thing to talk about. We have three main student federations that have been in the main sort of leadership role. But again, at this point, the movement has expanded so far beyond students, and you have so many people. You know, you go to these protests, there are young families, there are kids, there are strollers, there's so much gray hair, it's gotten so much bigger. But in terms of the student groups, you have the class, which is sort of traditionally the most radical group, and they're a very left-wing, a very progressive student association, and they represent actually the majority of students that are on strike. And then you have the FUC and the FEC, who are more moderate groups who used to be larger but have actually lost a lot of membership and lost a lot of stature over the course of this dispute because they were perceived as not being as radical as the class. And so in terms of the student population in this province, you have a very radicalized student body, that's for sure.
And I noticed the I wonder about opposition to it. If the the people who are concerned about radicals in the street, you've said that some pundits are screaming about mob rule, anarchy in the streets, and the dissolution of society as we know it. How is that connecting with people? Is that sense that just this radical rabble on the streets, and is that getting some traction as well?
Well, there's a big linguistic disconnect.
Yeah.
So in the English media, in the rest of Canada, but also here in Quebec, it's just wall-to-wall bashing the students constantly all the time to absurd extremes, right? It's very clear to see when you look at the level of vitriol that's leveled at the students and at this movement, how much of a threat it really is to the status quo, because there's just, you pick up the Montreal Gazette, which is the main English language newspaper in this city, there's an average of like three or four different columns and editorials just lashing into the students every day, and it's just so over the top. And then on the French side, you have a fairly different situation. Not that it's great, not that the coverage is great, but it's much more balanced. Le Devoir, which is one of the main newspapers, is arguably not exactly pro-student, but certainly I would say at least fair. And, their editorial position, they came out with a unanimous editorial opposing Bill 78 and calling it a draconian violation of civil liberties. They were hearing reports this weekend. We had the Grand Prix in Montreal, and there was a lot of political profiling going on. So this newspaper actually sent two of their journalists with red squares, and a little square of red felt pinned to one's lapel is the symbol of this movement, or of solidarity with this movement. And so they sent two journalists wearing red squares onto the metro, and they were singled out and targeted. They were searched, when they tried to enter the island where the Grand Prix racetrack is, which is also a public park with a public beach and an amusement park and a bunch of other things, they were stopped and detained and put in handcuffs and really threatened with violence and forced off the island. And so they were there. They actually did this great sort of investigative story showing the extent to which there was political profiling going on, and people were being arrested and searched and really illegally detained on the basis of wearing a political symbol. So in the French press, you've had a mixed bag. There's more the tabloid Journal de Montréal and La Presse have been more anti-student because they're both owned by sort of major corporate interests. But there has been a fairly significant linguistic disconnect between the French and the English side.
Well, I wonder if there's any kind of, for example, pollster Christian Bork said, instead of creating, quote, a law and order consensus, Bill 78 appears to have divided Quebecers, especially along generational lines. What do you have to say about that?
I'm not so sure that generational is accurate. When you go to these demonstrations, it's surprising how many older people are there. I think after Bill 78, I think it really, people, even older people, people that might not have supported the students, really, they remembered back to, you have to remember, people who are older, they lived through the War Measures Act. And so they lived through a time when the Canadian Army was on the street and when people were arrested without charge. And that's a very black mark in our history and something that people remember quite distinctly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of older people who might not have been sympathetic to the students, when they saw Bill 78 and they realized its implications, it brought back memories of that period in our history, and they became very sympathetic. So, you know, to an extent, there's a generational divide, but it shouldn't be understated the extent to which the protests are drawing people of all ages into the street. I was walking down the street the other day, and I saw a guy who had to have been like 85. You know, he was, you know, having fairly significant trouble walking with two canes, and he was wearing a red square proudly on his lapel. So, you know, it's not quite as clear cut as that.
Interesting. Again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with Ethan Cox, a 28-year-old organizer from Montreal. Things are hot and exciting up there. And speaking of which, I read that there were riots at a Liberal Party general council meeting in Victoriaville. Was it a riot, and what was that all about?
Well, it wasn't a riot.
Somehow I didn't think so.
Well, when our hockey team wins in the playoffs or loses in the playoffs, we have a tendency of having riots. We haven't had any in the course of this this situation.
Right.
But yeah, the similar sort of thing as always, right? I mean, you have a situation where there were mass protests outside of the Quebec Liberal Party Congress in Victoriaville. And, you know, some demonstrators maybe throw some stuff at police. I'm not quite sure which happened first. It's mm-hmm. always a little unclear, but
right.
it's often the police who attack demonstrators first, and then demonstrators respond and, you know, what have you. But, it was basically a situation of the police really, attacking demonstrators. For the most part, what happened was that the police were attacking demonstrators with batons, with tear gas, with pepper spray, and with rubber bullets, and you know, caused some fairly severe injuries to several people there. Since the beginning of this thing, two people have lost an eye, and there have been a wide variety of other fairly serious injuries at the hands of the police. People are getting charged and beaten with batons in the street with no provocation. And really, I don't think it's a stretch to say that the police are out of control. We have CUTV, which is actually Concordia University Television, is an independent campus television station, which has been broadcasting live on the internet from all of the demonstrations. So they've been live streaming from all of these demonstrations, and really in the process revolutionizing how we interact with social movements, by allowing everybody that's not able to go to the protest for geographical or other reasons to have a window into exactly what's happening at any given time at a protest. And obviously the government and the police don't like that too much. And so they've been repeatedly targeted by police. Their camera's been broken about six or seven different times. Their station manager suffered a severe concussion. One of their cameramen had two ribs broken. They sort of routinely get targeted and attacked by the police. So we're seeing, unfortunately, a situation of a fairly high level of police brutality, which is also what was happening in Victoriaville.
Wow. You know, it's amazing to me, once again, how obvious it is that police brutality, people get it. It backfires every single time. So I wonder if the government, I mean, what can they do here? What would you suggest to the Liberal Party, to Charest? What can they do realistically to help bring some peace? Are they totally backed in a corner and it's like a real, real battle here? Not so much a physical battle, but one that one side is going to win, the other is going to lose.
It's very hard to say. I mean, I think the bottom line is nobody's going to get off the street until, at a bare minimum, there's a deal with the students and Bill 78 is repealed. I think that's clearly a baseline. But I'm not sure if those two conditions were satisfied, if it would end everything. And I think at this point, what you're looking at, you know, for the protest on the 22nd of this month, what organizers are looking for is 500,000 people in the streets calling for Charest's resignation.
Uh-huh.
So we're getting to a point where it may well take his resignation to resolve the issue, but it's hard to say, right? I think, you know, as I said, the bottom line is there has to be some sort of a fair deal for students, and Bill 78 has to be repealed, and I think without that, you're going to see continued protests for a long time.
I wonder if the government has the wiggle room to repeal Bill 78, or does the government have to fall before it gets repealed?
Well, you know, like you said, they're very much backed into a corner right now. They've been extraordinarily stubborn and and just, you know, I can't imagine how stupid the government has been on so many different occasions. They've just really, really done the worst possible thing in the situation.
Amazing.
So they don't seem to be acting very smartly, even in their own self-interest here. And, yeah, they backed themselves badly into a corner, and they really don't seem to have any inclination to negotiate or to try and extricate themselves from it. I think they just think they can wait it out, and eventually things will fizzle out.
It doesn't sound like that's going to happen. I keep getting a sense of thinking back to recent history. In fact, it's still going on. The whole Occupy movement here in the Southland in the United States. How similar is it, do you think? Are there parallels, or is that a bit of a stretch?
No, I think there's certainly parallels. I mean, it's like I said, it's all part of the same struggle. Our system is broken, and it's like the emperor without any clothes, right? For a long time, we've been staring at the emperor that's buck naked up there and going, yeah, it's a lovely suit. And I think people are kind of realizing, you know what, that guy doesn't have any clothes on. So in the States and Canada, everywhere, we're saying, look, you know, this whole system is broken. This whole economic system is based around benefit for a very tiny minority of the population.
Right.
And gee, no wonder, because they're the people that fund the political campaigns of the politicians. They're the people that own the media. And this system is broken. And so we need to stand up, and we need to start taking action to try and make sure that we have a government that is actually governing in the best interests of the majority. Because that's not what's happening. It's not what's happening in Quebec, in Canada nationally, in the States. It's not what's happening anywhere. We have governments that are governing in the interests of a very narrow minority. And that's the unifying problem that really needs to be addressed. And I think what we're trying to do in terms of exporting this movement and calling for people to organize solidarity casseroles this Wednesday and again on the 22nd is saying that the only way that we're going to win is to recognize that our struggles are linked, and that whether your concern is with the environment, with labor rights, with social issues, whatever it is, the problem is the same. And we're only going to win by having one broad, unified movement against a broken system.
Everything you just said could apply absolutely to the Occupy movement. It seems like the larger question, both here in the United States and in Canada, is who does the government serve? Is it our government? Government is supposed to be us organizing together, working for the common good. And unless I'm hearing you wrong, it sounds like that's really a similar question there, and that this tuition increase was really what got the ball rolling, and that people seem to be getting that message louder and louder and louder. So in an ideal world, Ethan, if you were making policy, how would this problem be fixed? Or is it much bigger than, just any one person coming up with a solution?
Well, it's not so much policy as it is who's in charge, right? We have the power. Fundamentally, this entire broken system is like a house of cards, and it rests on our consent, on our accepting it. As soon as we stop accepting it, as soon as we start taking the power back, then it loses its moral authority. As you said, government depends on the consent of the governed. And, so we need to start, working together to take down governments that are serving a minority and figuring out ways to, you know, especially circumvent the mass media, because one of the biggest problems is just the completely skewed view of things that the mass media gives, and unfortunately that most people accept. And that's something we're seeing here in Quebec with how this social movement is being portrayed in the rest of the country in the English language media, who are just terrible. And that's a big problem, right? And we need to figure out ways to communicate with each other, to connect. And that's something that's happened in Quebec with these casseroles, is that, you know, the mainstream media can scream and holler all they want about how it's anarchy in the streets and the dissolution of society. People no, that's not true. People go out on their streets and they meet up with their neighbors and they talk to each other. And so they're replacing their source of information from the television or the newspaper with seeing what's actually happening. And so they're getting out on the streets and going, well, you know, look, what I'm being told in the newspaper is nonsense. That's simply not true. And so we need to figure out ways to communicate with each other and to build movements that can work outside of the constraints of the mainstream media.
Well, there's nothing like adversity as an organizing tool to bring people together. And it sounds like the government has been doing that very, very effectively. If people want to be keep in touch with this, you have rabble.ca, is that right? How else can people keep in touch with that? And if they want to be supportive, what any suggestions?
Well, basically, the search Casserole Night in Canada on Facebook. All you got to do if you want to support this movement is create a Facebook event for your town, for your community. You know, nothing's too small to have a casserole. Just it just starts with you and a pot and a pan. Get out on create a Facebook event, invite some people, tell your friends. Even if it's just four or five of you, send us the information on the Facebook page. We'll list it as a support casserole and send us photographs, and it makes a big difference. And for people in Quebec, it's made a huge difference to see the solidarity from people around the world, and so it really does matter. So if you it doesn't take much time, create a Facebook event for your town. Submit that link to the main Facebook national page so we can list it. Send us your photos, tweet the hashtag Casserole Night in Canada, and just show your solidarity, and it really does make a difference.
And the main Facebook page again is what?
Well, people can search for Casserole Night in Canada on Facebook and they'll find it.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much, sir. It's an interesting time up in the North Montreal. And again, Ethan Cox, and you write for rabble.ca, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And people can also check out my articles on rabble.ca. There's links to the Facebook page at the end of them as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And yet another interesting thing to watch on the international scene. Thanks for being with us on The Bert Cohen Show.
Thanks, Bert. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Volunteers of America, volunteers of America, volunteers of America.